The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
This is the Anton Savage Show, and that's Brian Burke. He is a gardening expert whose hair looks tremendous today. I should say it on air. I said it during the break, but it's true. It looks magnificent in person. If you have any gardening questions, 087 1400 106 on WhatsApp, or you can get them in by text to 53106. Text say, I have been experimenting with all sorts of plants for a few years in a long strip of a bed I have beside a lawn area. I can never seem to get it to amount to anything. Are there any basic principles I'm missing?
Right, okay. Never seem to get it to amount to anything. I mean, there could be several things going on there. Long strip beside a lawn area. It could be the aspect. You could be putting shade-tolerant plants into a sunny exposed area. And the opposite could be true. You could be putting plants that want sun into a shade area.
Are there certain plants that you can get inside the house where they're pretty much unkillable. They'll survive a nuclear winter. You don't really have to water them. I can't remember what they are. One of them is long and has thin triangular leaves.
Sansevieria, probably.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Are there any of them for outdoor area where you just can't kill the thing?
Yeah, well, there are some. Like, perennial grasses are great for that, you know? Like what that person is doing there, like, if it's a long strip, I would imagine, right, the aspect could be wrong, and there could be issues with the soil, and there could also be an overdependence on one particular type of plant. You know, they might be putting the emphasis, say, on plants that flower within the same window of time during the summer. And then for the rest of the year, it looks pretty decrepit. They're getting a bit frustrated. So what I would suggest, if you have a long bed like that, it's basically a border. And what we're all about now is we're getting away from the dependence on herbaceous plants for borders. It's about the mixed planting approach. So the mixed planting approach is all about trying to ensure that there's something going on at all times of the year, you know, from spring through to early summer, midsummer, late summer, autumn and winter, you know. So you do that by dipping into the palette of plant types that are out there, you know, from your bulbs, your biennials, your annuals, your perennials, your perennial grasses, small shrubs, large shrubs, deciduous shrubs. There's a whole range. Like if you dip in and out and take ingredients from all of those different areas, you will get something that's going to provide interest and dynamism the whole year round. But the trick is to try and mix it up a little bit, you know. I'd say there's an overdependence on one type there.
To what extent do you have to plant every year? Or is it possible to get a garden to a point where you say, it's now done and it will just go and appear every year and I don't have to keep maintaining the thing?
That is possible, but there is maintenance involved. Like, so that model I've just been describing there, the mixed planting approach, a fairly major constituent of that would be herbaceous perennial planting. That's great, right? But it'll thicken up, it'll get congested, it'll clump. Every so often you'll need to get in there, lift it out, dig them out, divide them. It's similar with anything woody, shrubs, trees, deciduous or evergreen. Every so often, they're going to need a bit of management. They're going to need damage control. You're going to need to rectify problems like crossing branches, rubbing branches, dying disease branches. But it's maintenance. It's a case of just maintaining what you have rather than constantly trying to reinvent the whole scheme, you know. So you can get it to a point.
I just realized that I owe you a debt of gratitude because about, I think, 3 years ago, I asked you about cutting back a hedge and you said that it would resent me for a couple of seasons and then it'd get on with its life.
Right.
This is the year that it's finally got on with its life after being hacked back by about a foot and it's starting to look almost non-patchy again.
Super. What sort of hedge is it?
Yellow. Bit of green.
Probably, is it golden privet, is it?
I think it might be a privet. Yeah. It's one of those, you know, when you ask a child to draw a hedge, they'll draw this one. It's that one.
Right, okay, yeah.
How do I keep slugs off young rhubarb? I assume they want to keep slugs off all rhubarb, but the question asks specifically about young ones.
Yeah, young rhubarb is starting to emerge now, looking very well, particularly with this nice burst of weather that we've had.
And there's a lot to be said for rhubarb. Rhubarb is an underestimated vegetable.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a rhizome. It'll grow from the smallest little morsel. It's so easy to propagate and divide. As long as you can maintain, take a bit of root system, split it, take a bit of root system with you and you can plant it and propagate it pretty much anywhere. It's very, very resilient. Keeping slugs. I mean, again, the slug control, cultural slug control, things like
cultural.
Yeah,
slugs have a culture.
Cultural control is what we refer to anything that's non-chemical or non-biological. So in pest and disease control in horticulture, pest and disease control falls into three categories, right? So there's chemical, biological and cultural. So cultural refers to anything that's not chemical or biological. And it can include things like cultivating. It can include mesh netting. It can include, in this particular instance, things like putting down greater gravel or crushed oyster shells or beer traps or copper strips to keep slugs at play. Beer traps, yeah. If you cut a half-litre plastic bottle in half, put a drop of fermented beer, you know the dregs of those cans that you have when you're bringing them to the recycling place? Tip a bit of that into a sliced half-litre bottle. Put it around your area where you want to keep the slugs bay. The slugs love the smell of it. They'll get attracted to it. They'll dive into the bottle. They'll get jarred. They'll keel over, and that'll be it.
I mean, as ways to go.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And does it genuinely work?
Strategy, yeah, yeah.
Why do we avoid? I mean, I know we should and blah, 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 and all sorts of commitment to the environment and so forth. But surely there's a lot to be said for chemicals.
Surely
I can go into a hardware store, buy a chemical, put it down, and it saves me a lot of hassle.
It saves a lot of hassle, but look at the bigger picture. I mean, we're getting away. Look at the extent to which we've embraced, like, mainstream knowledge of ecology, biodiversity, restoration of ecosystems, all of that stuff has escalated significantly in the last few years. Part and parcel of that, inherent in that approach, is an avoidance of chemicals at all costs. So chemicals should only ever be a last resort and in very small quantities. I mean, there are so many weapons in our armory to deal with weeds, pests, diseases, things like slugs, that are not dependent on the chemical approach. So those should be our first port of call.
Do slugs serve any useful purpose? I mean, I'm sure birds eat them and so forth, but you know the way there are what are the little cow god, what's he called? Ladybirds, that they eat aphids. Slugs do anything like that useful?
Not really, but they are part of a food chain. So things like shrews and voles and small mammals will eat slugs. And birds, of course, will eat slugs. Frogs, a very important part of the food chain. Frogs love slugs. Really good cultural control. Right, for slugs, again, is to incorporate a small aquatic habitat into your garden. If you can get a small pond...
Where am I going to get a small aquatic habitat?
Aquatic habitat is simple to build. Excavate that, scoop out a bit of soil, you know, excavate a depression in the garden, put in a bit of builder's film or a bit of rubber liner, let it fill with water, plant some marginal plants around it. Frogs will come. Frogs will sense the water. If you build it, they will come. This is the Costner approach. If you build it, they will come.
Frogs of dreams.
Yeah, frogs of dreams. They'll come and they will take care of your slug problem. It's a natural, one of those natural predatory arrangements that, again, is getting away from the dependence on chemicals.
Texas, a beer trap known as a slug pub in our house. It can be quite disconcerting, though, when you see the body count. So obviously they must be extremely effective.
Yeah.
Our laurel hedge has gone all brown and bare. I thought it was just our hedge, but I noticed other laurel hedges around the area are the same. This did not happen other years. Is this related to the huge winds during Storm Owen? Yowen? I can say my apologies to the Welsh. And will the hedges recover?
Laurel will recover. Laurel, it's pretty much impossible to decimate laurel. Laurel is so resilient, so tough. I would say that it's probably just had a bit of damage, maybe a bit of early pruning. Sometimes can be a problem with laurels. People prune them before the risk of frost has passed. So that can be an issue, and that can result in damage that shows itself, you know, for a couple of years. But it will recover. They're very, very resilient. They grow pretty much anywhere. Very, very tough. So I wouldn't worry.
I have an Alstroemeria plant.
Alstroemeria, yeah.
Okay. And it's starting to sprout again. It's spreading out and bits of it are coming up in the middle of other plants. Mm. Can I dig them up without doing damage? It's a beautiful coloured plant.
Yeah, it's a beautiful colour. Summer, I can't remember the name of the variety that looks absolutely fabulous late in the summer. It's kind of an orange plant, perennial. You can dig those up. They're a plant that are really suitable for taking a slice of the basil plate, i.e. you work your way down, slice it, like the root system is very, very fleshy and very easy to detach. As long as you take a bit of what we call the basal plate, which is the cluster of root hair at the bottom of the plant, you can then propagate them elsewhere. So slice them off and then put them into other pots or into other beds and they'll be perfectly happy.
Tech saying laurel is a nasty invasive. Get rid of it.
Yeah, it depends on the setting. I mean, in an ornamental setting, in a kind of built-up areas, laurel are kind of the go-to hedging plant, you know, a bit like privet. But in natural environments, we're trying to get away from them because they're so invasive. They do so much damage now in natural woodlands, in our national parks. They're right up there with rhododendron ponticum in terms of because they're evergreen, they totally deprive the canopy layer of the woodlands or the forest lands from light.
They allow nothing else to grow. So the forest floor, the bluebells, all of that natural progression, all that natural succession that should happen, it totally interferes with that. So that person is absolutely right. They are a problem.
Although I believe Killarney is starting to win the battle against the rhododendron.
Yeah, the Rhodo Rangers down there are doing a great job. Yeah, yeah. And fair play to them. They're out every weekend on a voluntary basis doing their bit to save the ecology of what should be a showpiece national park, you know.
And our rhubarb texter sends their gratitude, by the way. Public service broadcasting.
Oh, thank you very much.
I was going to say glad that we could help. It was Brian who did all the heavy lifting, let's be clear. By the way, on invasive plants, mint is very impressive when it gets going.
Yeah, you need to contain it. You definitely do. Don't just let it give it free rein in a bed. You need to contain it.
It appears everywhere, and it appears 3 feet away from where it was the last time. You think, how'd you manage to get over there?
Oh, yeah, it'd be in the bed beside you if you gave it a chance.
A text saying, is my constant smoke from my barbecue in the good weather doing any harm to my plants and flowers? My God, you'd really want to be using the barbecue to harm your flowers, wouldn't you?
I'd love to know what you're barbecuing. No, I wouldn't think so. I mean, that's so transient. I mean, it's not like you're out there 24-7. So you barbecue for an hour, the smoke disappears. I can't imagine that that's doing any problems.
I wonder, does it dissuade bugs in any way? I mean, you know the way you smoke out beehives to make the bees a bit tired before you steal their stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, again, if you look at what's happening, it's an open air situation. So that smoke is dissipating very quickly into the atmosphere. It's not really concentrating in any particular area.
Texts say hedgehogs and birds will come to your frog pond and eat them. I don't know if that's a nihilistic view about the likely success of frogs remaining in your garden, or if it's a comment about biodiversity that the frogs will survive this onslaught but bring birds.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these food chains are all... once you build one thing, one ingredient, something else will happen. That's one of the great ways of advocating biodiversity in the garden. Like, food chains lead to food webs, lead to collections of organisms depending on each other, mutualistic predatory relationships.
Food symbiotic webs.
Food webs, yeah. So food webs, so food chains, like the classic example of something at the center of a food web is the oak, the mature oak tree in a mature woodland, right? So the oak tree is at the center of several food webs. So it's part of food chains that involve insects, that involve birds, that involve amphibians, some native reptiles, and some small mammals. So all of those are interconnected. So the oak tree is often held up as the classic example of how to create a food web. The
text
intersection of several chains.
I have an Australian lilac bush, quite big. A big hole appeared last winter and it's all brown. I've given it loads of water. Any suggestions? I don't want to lose it.
A big hole appeared. I wonder what, in a leaf or just in the centre of the plant? I wonder, did they lose a lot of the woody structure of it? I mean, it could have something fungal. It could be something like, God forbid, Erwinia amylivora, which is a fire blight. Now, lilac wouldn't be known to be particularly susceptible to that. But if it is that, you got to dive in there and you got to cut out anything that's anyway damaged or anything that looks like it might acquire damage in the near future and get rid of it, you know? You just have to, it could be fungal, it could be bacterial, but I would cut out anything that's damaged and get rid of it and just see what happens.
Why? Because it continues to spread through the plant if you
exactly.
don't?
Exactly. Something like fire blight. Fire blight is more synonymous with fruit trees, apple trees, pear trees, things like that. But if you do see an incidence of it, it requires ruthless cutting out of what's affected and getting rid of it because it is contagion.
On the topic of cutting things out, a text, I never know what or when to prune this time of year. What are the general rules? I've loads of trees and shrubs in the garden, a mixture of deciduous and evergreen, old and new.
Okay, well, what to prune? Well, this time of the year, I mean, again, basic rule of thumb is if it flowers in this year's wood, prune it now, right? A classic example of that would be something like a buddleia or a fuchsia, right? So prune it back really hard now. It's going to prune on that new growth. It's going to put on new growth that it's going to flower on later in the year. If something flowers on previous year's growth, and again, classic examples in the shrubby context would be things like Philadelphus, Weigela, Forsythia. You wait till they're finished flowering, then you prune them back. The logic there is that you're giving the plant a whole year to put on new wood upon which it will flower next season, thereby maximising the blossoms next year. Apart from that, you're pruning for shape and you're pruning for damage. So the classic is the 4 Ds. Dead, dying, diseased and damaged shoots. Anything that's crossing, looks like it's dead, dying or damaged, cut them out. You're pruning for shape, you're pruning for aesthetics, you're pruning for an open centre, pruning for ventilation. Just some basic principles.
Give me them again. Dead, dying,
diseased
damaged.
And damaged, the 4 Ds. And put a C in there as well, crossing. Crossing shoots.
Anything I don't. Rubbing. The 4 Ds were lovely.
4 Ds and a C.
don't you adulterate my Ds.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.